Kevin, good to see all the members here. We have a fairly long list of bills to get through, and I hope we can work efficiently and across the board here. With that, I'm going to open up a... Mr. Olson needs to make a clarification.
Members, we're going to be passing out a revised staff measure summary for House Bill 2037, an additional amendment. I accidentally printed out the wrong version, so that will be coming to you to replace the version that you have.
Which one? 2037.
It replaces the staff measure summary, and then there's an additional amendment. There's two possible amendments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2217. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2217 increases the corporate minimum tax that applies to C corporations for Oregon sales, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2007, establishes a corporate minimum tax fund for net revenues, dedicates monies in the fund to Head Start programs, Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, workforce development programs, takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment. You have before you, members, a dash 3 amendment which deletes most of the text of House Bill 2217 and would set a blank for the rate of the corporate minimum tax, deleting the tax rates and brackets in the current bill, leaving it for the Revenue Committee to determine the tax rate. It also deletes references to Oregon sales. And it would dedicate the corporate minimum tax fund to the Department of Higher Education and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. House Bill 2217 has a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Members, I ask for these amendments on this bill to suggest a policy to send a revenue that if a corporate minimum increase does occur this session, that higher education, community colleges, and workforce would be the area for that additional revenue to go through. I appreciate the consideration of it, and I would be happy to either take discussion first or a motion first. Either one works. So at this point, discussion. Any questions or comments?
Representative Robin?
I'll just move the dash.
That would be fine. I'll take that motion.
Okay. I'll move the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2217.
Representative Robin has moved the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2217. Discussion. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Although I'm a big supporter of Head Start, Oregon Opportunity Grants, and the Workforce Development Programs, I'll be a no. And one of the reasons I think that I'll be is on 2214 already has the money for the workforce development program part of this package.
Any further discussion?
No, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim.
And are we removing all the amount in the original bill?
We are not, Representative. The original amount has been lifted out of the bill by the amendment.
All of it.
Entirely.
Okay.
So we're sending a blank slate to revenue with the, if we pass this bill, with the recommendation from the Education Committee that the corporate minimum increase, if it happens, should be directed towards higher education, community colleges, and workforce development.
Okay. And another question, Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Instead of open to this funds, why do we have to dedicate this amount to a particular project?
It's an excellent question, Representative. I brought forth the amendment with the desire to make the point that the highest needs, again, this is just my opinion, the highest needs that we have currently in our budget situation are directed towards higher education and our community college system. I am greatly concerned of the many years of our disinvestment in higher education and community colleges that have placed us at a point of crisis, and I believe this is a statement that a policy committee could make if it so chooses to, and I am asking our committee to do so.
Okay, one more question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
And is this amount going on top of the possibly the governor's recommended budget?
Representative, there is no amount to this bill, so this is a blank slate for revenue.
For right now, it's blank.
Correct.
Yeah.
But this would be an amount that would, at least as I would understand the process now, this would be an amount that would go above what the co-chair's budget is currently.
Okay.
Chair.
Senator Gulick.
Thank you. The way this is written, could some of these funds be used for construction as well as for operations, or is going to OUS limited to use in operations? I mean, under the assumption anybody cares what we say here.
I was just trying to find out what it is. Given that context, Representative, the way it's written, it could go through anything that the Department of Higher Education.
It could go to covers. Go to construction right. As well as that.
But the context of your question is appreciated, and again, this is just a statement of opinion from us to our colleagues.
And a good one, one I concur with. I just wanted to make sure that it does. Allow the possibility of being used for construction, which is at the moment maybe an even higher need in higher education than operating funds. Well, it's hard to say. They both need it.
What's that called?
Thank you. Just for clarification, Chair Buckley, can it be interpreted that with so many things deleted in the dash threes that it virtually sends this original intention of increasing the corporate corporate minimum tax that applies to C corporations in Oregon to the Revenue Committee without a recommendation, or is the recommendation really important, is in there for community colleges and workforce development? I mean,
that's when
I need a little guidance from you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. The gist of the amendment is to take away the details that were proposed originally
right.
in House Bill 2217.
It appears so.
And to change the source where the corporate minimum tax fund would dedicate its funds to be instead of the pre-kindergarten programs, opportunity grant programs, and workforce development, to change it to higher education and community college workforce development.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. From my perspective, I appreciate these amendments because we had this discussion when this bill first came up, why are we talking about a revenue bill? And it was really all about the corporate minimum and all that. And what we really wanted to have a discussion was, if we did that, is this an appropriate place to put it? And I think I'm one of those people who fundamentally doesn't like dedicating these kinds of funds, but this is a statute that we can deal with, and it is also saying to people that we clearly in the Education Committee believe that we have to find more revenue for these places, and as a policy, I think it's a really great way of doing it. So I appreciate what you've done, and that's why I moved those amendments.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that, Representative. There's some discussion on the amendments, Representative Dollar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your work and understand the difficulty of putting together something that will work, but I have three things that concern me greatly. One is, as we get on the agenda to 2214, is the governor's plan for 61%, which is a concept I have to support. I was excited when it was 51%. I have a few things to check on that, but if we do 2214 and we do this one, we've identified the community colleges as recipients twice. A favorite program of mine is workforce development. I sit on that committee. And if we're going to succeed in Oregon, it's going to be with that. But the earmarking troubles me. The next spot that troubles me is the blank slate that we send to Ways and Means. I have real problems with that. Those three things, I think, will cause me to have to really take a long look at this bill and I'll do a more vote.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussions? Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My earlier comments, I had not looked at the amendment or had not found the amendment yet. But I would point out that your bill now takes away the Head Start program as a possible. It's only the Oregon, and it takes away the Opportunity Grant program, too. And it now only provides for these funds to go to the Department of Higher Ed and community colleges and workforce. So the statement is still true that 2214 will have money for the community colleges and workforce development. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative
Lynn.
And
I think it's a good deal with the Dash 3 amendment. And perhaps the last 15 to 20 years that we have disinvested in the higher education, especially community colleges. And then the community colleges, $3,000 a year, that the tuition for students, this is really too high. As a matter of fact, the highest in the 17 states, mm-hmm. in the western states. So I think this is a good investment. And you have my support on this.
Thank you, Mr. Yeah. Okay. Any further discussion on the amendments?
We should probably call the roll on these amendments. Annie, if you would.
Representative
Sun. Excuse.
Representative Don.
No.
Representative Greenlake.
Which on the amendments?
On the amendments.
Yes, it doesn't matter which one. I don't care what it is, I mean, yes.
Representative
Kopp? Aye.
Representative Kohl?
Excuse.
Representative Lim?
Aye.
Representative Groblin?
Aye.
Representative Wisnet?
Nay.
Chair Buckman?
Aye.
If I have the count right, any bill is so amended? Well, thank you for the vote on the amendment. We have Representative Robin.
Chair, okay, I move the House Bill 2217 to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee by prior reference.
President Robin has moved House Bill 2217 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. I'm hearing we should get Representative Crummell. Is Representative Crummell in the hall?
He is. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I see discussion. Vice Chair Kopp.
Chair Buckley, I will be supporting this a bill to send it to Revenue for the bigger debate, and just want to be on the record that when we're talking about the corporate minimum, that I do not want it applied to sales. I want to be the gross or whatever the net is after sales. I don't know all those terms, but I really think just if you just apply it to sales, it really might create some hardship for small businesses. I had a number of small business owners in my district discuss this topic with me, so I will be supporting the bill. Just so the Revenue Committee can do as they see fit, but I just want it on the record.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. One of the reasons I think we held back on moving this bill forward because of the feedback we received, particularly from small businesses.
Right.
The Revenue Committee is working on a couple of approaches to corporate minimum that are quite different than the original approaches, and I look forward to seeing the fruits of their labor sometime soon.
Thank you.
Any further discussion, Senator Crum?
Mr. Chairman, I support the bill. Sorry, I've been laying upstairs ill, but I know about this bill. I know the arguments about it. I watch it on TV. It's come down to vote. I support it, having the Revenue Committee take a look. Again, the problem is you can't really just go on net income. Otherwise, you will end at zero net income, and then you'll pay a corporate minimum tax. So they're going to have to figure it out.
Yeah.
But that way won't do it either. So thank you.
They're on the process of doing it.
It's no income before you send it somewhere else.
Right.
Good discussion.
I just want to clarify something.
Is that correct?
Here, if I may, with staff. Mm-hmm. So if... we're just, with the Dash 3 amendment, we're just clarifying that the corporate minimum, whatever it is going to go to community colleges, workforce development, and higher education, period. Is that correct?
It's higher ed.
What do you mean, no higher ed?
No, it's higher ed, yes.
So it says insert the Department of Higher Education and B, the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development Verification.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, you are correct. And in addition to address Representative Kopp's point, it does delete the language that discusses Oregon sales, so it strips it down to give some flexibility to Revenue on how to determine.
It's interesting, Mr. Chair, because there is this question about whether or not, you know, we should be dedicating funding for you know, a variety of different sorts of things. And the bill that we're going to see later that takes 61% of the total state expenditures and guarantees it to education enterprise. It's all rather interesting, because then what we're doing is that we're leaving 39% for the rest of the state budget, which includes human services, which everybody feels is very important. And services that we do for human services are very important. I don't know if these kinds of percentages are going to get us there. Because also within that has to come the legislative budget and the judiciary budget, and that's within that 39% also. And as soon as you talk about education, public safety, and human services, you just described 98% of the budget. The question that I have on this bill, even with the amendment, is where does that place? Is this calculated as part of the 61%, or is this calculated as outside of the 61%? Which means then it's part of the 39%, which means that you're eroding into the other budgets even more. On behalf of education. And so that brings up some real questions for me, and it's creating a conflict.
Understandable. If it helps at all, we on the bill with the 61% proposal, if we move that today, we'll be giving to rules, not to ways and means. And again, that wouldn't have an effect. The 61% rules doesn't have an effect with this biennium. So the bill that I'm putting forward today is basically a statement from the Education Committee on this biennium's budget, on the biennium's coming up, budget, to say, given where the co-chairs have us, given the discussion on a corporate minimum, a policy statement from our committee is that if a corporate minimum is increased, we would like to see it go to higher education and workforce development. This does not, of course, mandate that be followed by any future legislature.
What I have the problem with is the potential increase, because I think, you know, with the amount of money that we have coming in at roughly 20% increase over last biennium, anything that's not revenue neutral, I'm going to have a hard time casting an eye vote on. From a standpoint of a policy, I don't necessarily disagree with the policy of saying, you know, we've got this corporate minimum pot, we're going to put it in here, and I just have to figure out for me, in terms of my conflict, whether it's part of the 61% or part of the 39%. But any increases in revenues, I'm at this point, I can't support it, because we have so much increased revenues coming in, and in my district, people are saying, you know what, you're taking enough out of my pocket already. Do with what you got.
Just thank you, Representative, and I appreciate your comments. I would respectfully disagree, previous discussion has shown, even with the type of budgets we're looking at for K-12 this session, we're still not back to where we were in 2001. So we've had a disagreement in terms of whether more is needed or not.
I'm going to respectfully disagree, right, Mr. Chair?
I do think he's making an important point, because this is a minimum tax on corporations, which would be a part of general fund revenue, as we talked about. My guess is this would be counted in the 61%. Well, we have governor's representative who might like to comment on that.
Mr. Sager, do you have any comments?
You're
always welcome to join us.
I'm sorry, I'm grimacing. I thought he had
that. You need to be careful of facial expressions on this one.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm James Sager with the governor's office. If I could try to explain the two different issues here. And Chair Buckley, you were right on the mark. As I understand this amendment and this bill, it affects revenue for this legislative session. If that becomes general fund revenue, because it is a corporate tax, then as it applies to House Bill 2214, which says 61% of general fund revenue is the calculation, then Representative Greenlick is correct that it would roll into future biennia as we do the calculation.
Thank you, Mr. Sage.
One final comment.
Mr. Incumbent.
I just wanted to also state that I'm pleased in the bill. It refers to the pre-kindergarten programs, because I still want to make my case that the Healthy Start is... I'll work on that another time. Thank you.
Representative Roblin's motion is on the table, and I'd like to call for a vote.
Yes.
Yes.
Representative Lim? Aye. Representative Roblin? Aye. Representative Griffin? Nay. Aye. The motion carries. Good luck in revenue. House Bill 2215.
R.I.P. Is that like the kiss on goodbye?
I used to do that, Representative, but I sent out manuscripts that I'd written. I'd kiss them before I said goodbye. Good luck on that one. Very good. I'd like to open up a work session on House Bill 2217. Open up the work session on House Bill 2037. Members, this might be the most the measure today that we want to have the most discussion on. So I do want to make sure we get time for it, but also please keep in mind we have the other bills to follow. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2037 allows public charter schools that offer online courses to have over 50% of its students reside in a district other than the school district in which the charter school is located. Applies to school year starting 2008 to 2008, declares an emergency, becomes effective July 1st. That's in the original bill. We have two amendments before you. The Dash 4 amendment would replace the entire text of House Bill 2037 and would define a, quote, virtual public charter school, unquote, add a provision allowing charter school applicants to apply for a waiver of the 50% rule, provide a detailed framework of the requirements a virtual public charter school must meet before the State Board of Education can waive the requirement that public charter schools that offer any online courses are required to have at least 50% of its students reside in the district in which the school is located, provide for an appeals mechanism if the board denies the virtual public charter school's request for a waiver, direct reporting requirements for a virtual public charter school granted a waiver, and clarify that these waiver procedures do not apply to existing public charter schools until the charter school's charter is amended or renewed. That's the Dash 4. The Dash 3 replaces the text of 2037. It includes the same, except it has does not... I'm sorry, there's a typo in the staff measure summary. It prohibits the judicial review of the State Board of Education denial of a virtual public charter school's appeal. And the Dash 3, it does not specifically prohibits judicial review. It also does not have some last-minute language that went in the Dash 4 that clarifies that a biweekly consultation between the teacher and the student could be done by telephone or virtually rather than in person. And this has subsequent to referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Members, if with your consideration, I'd like to focus the discussion on the Dash 4 amendments. Representative Dahlem has done a tremendous amount of work, which I'm very appreciative of. I do believe we still have some disagreement over the Dash 4. I also would allow folks who would like to talk on the Dash 4 to come forward if they would like to. Representative Dahlem, do you want to give us a little bit of a point of view?
Since the last time we had this bill in front of this committee, we assembled, I think, everybody that had an interest in it that we could find, and some that didn't have any interest. The Dash 2 is a result of one of the people in our committee wanted to be sure that that the final review officials by the State Board of Ed. I'm going to look at my notes here. The dash two would be, or the dash three would remove that, and then as we looked at the dash three when they came out, there was one inconsequential change that it said that the charter school had to meet with parents six times a year on the telephone. Well, if they met in person, that wouldn't have counted, so we took care of that and said that the relationship had to be established at least six times a year. We then, with the dash four, simply dropped out any reference to appeal. That puts three amendments in front of you right now. As I see it, you'll have to do two, three, or four, but you can't do two, three, and four, because two is in opposition to three and four, and three and four is contained in two. Do I have that correct? Don't I look at that correct?
But I thought the
yes.
chair said he wanted to focus on that.
I'm sorry, I was under the impression that four was taking, that four was conclusive, was a comprehensive amendment.
Yes. We came to the committee with a discussion. And one party in our work group wanted to be sure that the appeal process stopped at the State Board of Ed. If I could ask Lori to come up and explain. First Amendment is...
I'm sorry, I was just going to say, I think I can clarify as well. The dash 2 has specific language prohibiting... the dash 2 specifically allowed judicial review of the State Board's appeal. The dash 3 specifically prohibits it, and the dash 4 does not comment about it.
Anyway, we have that right.
That's a compromise.
That is a dash amendment.
There's one more cell, right?
Was it coming to the
I have a comment before we start taking questions and having an in-depth dialogue, potentially. Call people's attention to the fact that this bill was heard first in a subcommittee on February 6th. At that time, Representative Cannon and Representative Dahlem agreed to begin a work group. They have done meetings up to three times a week. We went out and visited sites. They have had every party available, I think, as part of their team and coming up with these. As you hear Vice Chair Dahlem speaking about the real technical aspects of this bill, and I've never seen people work harder on a bill in a long time, and so I just want you to know that I personally like the dash fours, and I think it says what everybody wants, but I'm certainly been wrong before in my life and will be actively listening to the conversation, but I want to thank everybody for their work.
Thank you, Representative. Ms. Grimmel-Whitland, do you like to comment on either the process or the product?
Please, Mr. Chair, for the record, Lori Wimmer-Whalen, representing the 46,000 members of the Oregon Education Association. First of all, to echo Representative Vice Chair Comp's comments about all the hard work that all of you have done on this bill, I'm regretfully going to have to inform you, though, that our fundamental objections remain for a number of reasons, and I'll go over them very quickly, so not to take too much of your time. First of all, at the end of the last session, the Oregon Legislature passed Senate Bill 1079 to create a state Oregon virtual school district so that students could access high-quality virtual education programs with both quality control standards in place. That's what this bill amends. It says that those districts that participate in virtual school programs shall have 50% or more of their students coming from within that district so that private vendors weren't coming in to basically harvest homeschool students from all over the state and creating what is in effect an open enrollment policy for the state, taking students out of their residential district without interagency agreements or anything else. The Oregon Virtual School District, which is housed at the Oregon Department of Education, I'm a member of the Virtual School Advisory Council, has been working all through the interim to get that up and running. And this seems to go in a very different direction and send as a The bill itself, even as you might amend it, sends a signal that you are expecting and desirous of the Department of Ed doing something very different from that structure. And in fact, encouraging the development more of the programs such as the one that's in the Scioto School District. And frankly, we don't support that. We don't believe that that necessarily is the best approach. And even while the criteria themselves are not really at issue, although they were not created by our work group, I would stipulate, we saw them after they were created. They were not. I never had any participation in the creation of, or the crafting of these, or anybody in our shop. But we don't necessarily take issue with the substance of the criteria for quality control so much as the direction itself, which creates this open enrollment problem and the financial management issues. And secondly, the dashboards, by removing all reference to judicial review, do not solve our problem about the probability that private vendors, for the sake of doing this business and having access to the profit from the state taxpayer dollars, would of course sue if they lose the waiver appeal. And they have that right unless they are explicitly, this is from Cindy Hunt when she came to our work group last week, unless they are explicitly told that the decision of the Department of Education is final, then appeals process have the right of judicial review. So by becoming silent on it, as the Dash Force do, that didn't solve our problem. It means that they still have access to that judicial review. We think this is a litigious society and there's a lot of money at stake, and we expect that the department will be in court unless they grant a lot of waivers, which we would hope they would not do. So as a result of both the fact that it creates this open enrollment problem and financial distress issues and does not route children through the virtual school district, we can't support the bill. And because of the judicial review, we certainly can't. We can't support the bill. We also believe that high-quality virtual education is more likely to be made available if we can continue to support and strengthen the Oregon School Virtual School District at the Department of Ed. And we have spoken with some of the vendors about how we might work with them to make sure that they have access to the RFP processes in the future so that they can work as part of that to offer their products to the students of Oregon, because some of them do have very high-quality products. And I have said privately, and I'll also say on the record, to those vendors that we would be interested in helping them get access to that means of providing that content. So with that, I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Any questions for Ms. Morrell?
I have some questions.
I'll just ask, just for my clarification, with the virtual school, the Oregon Virtual School, how would a homeschool student access the Oregon Virtual School? You're referencing?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the way that's done is through the school district, but I think you can also go dial directly up to the vendor. I think Steve Nelson from the Department of Ed is probably the best person to ask that right. question.
Just out of curiosity, I appreciate it.
Yeah. No problem. Representative Kopp?
I have a couple of questions, if I might just proceed through them.
Yes, that'll be fine.
Okay. Thank you for coming in, Ms. Wilmer Whalen. And it's my understanding the Department of Ed's virtual school district is a portal. I have had it explained to me several times by people in the department that it is there for the use of teachers as a learning tool for their classrooms. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Madam Vice Chair, I believe that that's its fundamental use.
Thank you. And I am aware of there's somewhere between 11 and 18 actual courses right now that are available to students, but that is just at the high school level, that the programs that this bill, particularly that Representative Cannon spoke to me repeatedly about, is for K-12. And is the portal just right now for high school for coursework?
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, our understanding was that the idea would be that it would offer as much content as it could get for K through 12. If they have not yet gotten that far, it's because it's still in development.
Yes, it is very preliminary. And the other question, the bill has been, and I don't know if I need staff on this one, the bill has, to my understanding from Representative Cannon again, has been focused about what is a quality virtual school with some guidelines to the State Board of Higher Ed, not to the Department of Education.
That's true.
State Board of Education.
Yes, because what's not currently in our statute books, and this is the energy that Representative Cannon has put 2 months of work into, is defining those guidelines. And those are just real important. I don't want to lose those. That would be my comment.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Greenick, you have quite good comments. Are there any other questions for her?
I have one question. maybe two. Didn't 1071, in essence, though, set up a de facto monopoly in SIO for virtual charter schools?
Mr. Chair,
was that the intention of the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crumwell, no, it was not the intention to establish a monopoly for that program. It did, however, pre-exist the law. So for the life of its contract, which I believe it was initiated in 2004, and it's a five-year contract, it would be exempt from the requirements of the law, but not upon renewal of its application or of its contract.
So then, if I may, Mr. Chair, so then over time, what it would do is have the effect, so for the first however many years, it would have the effect of, the de facto effect of a monopoly, or a de facto monopoly, I mean, and then, but once that contract was going to be changed, then it would have the effect of killing it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Crumwell, I don't think that it necessarily would, because there are a number of other charter virtual school providers in school districts. For example, Cool School in Lynn Benton Community College. There's one in North Clackamas, Salem Kaiser Online. Various other district quality programs that met all the criteria and have operated and will continue to operate. So they're certainly not a monopoly, and they also are participating and cooperating with the Oregon Virtual School District. Also, the Connections Academy could do so.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair, follow on. So, at present, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this, at present, the only complete program that's a virtual school, though, is Oregon Connections Academy. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crumwell, could you define what you mean by complete?
I mean, that all of the classes that a student attends are online. Because North Clackamas, for example, if they don't get all of their classes online, they go to a bricks and mortar. The student would go to a bricks and mortar school, or they go to a bricks and mortar school, and then they can augment. If there's a class, for example, that they can't get for some reason at the bricks and mortar school, they could take it online through the district.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crumwell, I believe there may be others that offer a full program.
Okay, that's fine. Mr. Chair, before we vote on this, I also need to declare a potential conflict of interest because I am employed when we're not in session by a virtual charter school.
Thank you, Representative. Anything more for Ms. Will Whalen? Mr. Lim.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Public virtual charter school, is that correct?
Yeah.
What happened if that the town, city nearby, the other state, big city, are they interchangeable or do they have to stay in the boundary of the state for the student?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, if you're referring to the state virtual charter school program, district?
This charter school I'm talking about.
The charter school.
Yes, the charter school.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, I don't know whether they can take students from out of state. I'm not aware of their ability to do that because they're getting Oregon dollars.
Please, so because they are chartered through a Oregon school district and can only school Oregon students.
It's an Oregon.
I do have a question. Yeah, would you help me with you have any amendments?
Yeah.
Can you tell me what this... What means a teacher who are highly qualified is described in the fellow No Child Left Behind?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I wish my lobby partner were here because she is our expert on NCLB. I am not. I'm sorry, I can't give you all the details, but there probably are people from the Department of Education who would be able to speak to that.
Would you like someone to come up from the department?
I think I can explain that to you. The issue to establish a qualified teacher, and we have two sets of standards that we could use. One was the teacher standards and practices, and so all teachers have to be licensed. The other standard that is outside of the state but does or could threaten a school's federal funding is No Child Left Behind. Their teachers have to be qualified to their standards. They have to be both. The requirements, there is no school in the state that has to meet all of these requirements. They're higher than what we have now. So I've been very, very clear about that. If you do not accept federal money, you don't have to meet No Child Left Behind. There's not very many. But we have two sets of standards listed.
Unless we say they have to meet both of those.
Yes, they have to meet them both. Now, the specific standards of No Child Left Behind, I think we do have some people in the room that know where they are, but that wasn't the issue.
All these waiver things, that's just one of the waiver things, if they want a waiver.
Yes.
What are they getting a waiver from?
The State Board of Ed can waive the 50% rule if our virtual school does all of these things. But then came the question, well, what if they do all of these things? Is approval mandatory? And so we took the word, we changed the wording, and through Ledge Council, a virtual charter school must meet all of these qualifications and any others that the State Board of Ed must establish. But these would be the minimum. And that's how the amendment reads.
So this simply gives a way out of that 50%.
This gives the State Board of Ed the authority to waive the 50% rule. In dealing with the State Board of Ed, they always had the authority to waive. And that was probably one of the first things we learned, was that the State Board of Ed could waive a rule. In talking with individual members of the State Board of Ed, when they spoke as individuals, they were somewhat reluctant to give a waiver because they had no legislative direction. And I think that we have done that. We have clearly said if a virtual school meets these requirements, plus any other state requirements, plus the requirements that you may have, then you would be very comfortable in waiving the 50% rule.
Mr. Chair, that would then give us another reason to object to the bill, because on page 4, line 21, it says that if the Board of Education does deny the waiver, that it must tell the virtual public charter school or applicant with the board's reasons for the denial and specific requirements under subsection 2 of this section that were not met, which implies that it does not require that it be one of these reasons and only one of these reasons that could be the grounds for the waiver. And while we said in the work group that would not necessarily be true, that this list is not the determinative and finite list, it certainly implies that with this requirement, and there could be other reasons having to do with some of the issues I mentioned about open enrollment and school district finances and other kinds of things that would also be reasons for denying the waiver, but yet which do not appear on this list of criteria.
Thank you. Further questions of Mr. Williams? Thank you very much for your testimony.
We do have Ledge Council.
And Ledge Council has joined us if there are questions of Ledge Council.
Am I correct that I hear correctly that money will follow the student out of the district and to this school?
When we got into that, Representative Greenlee, yes. There are several things that happen. One, the host school gets some administrative money. Now, that looks like a great deal of money when you add it all up and put it in a pile. But as the superintendent of the Sayre School District gave us testimony, he does get some money from that, and they have become, that is extra income for them. In fact, this child is born of innovation to see how they can keep that district alive. So the host school, when you establish charter, would get some money. But they also write checks to the schools that send the children. So if a student enrolls in Mosier, in this charter school, the Mosier school then would get some money from them. So, and then, of course, the provider is paid with the remainder of the proceeds. So there are three people in the money game.
Unfortunately, he wasn't available to listen to the answers. It was an excellent answer.
I could see that, but I'm not sure I wanted him to have the answer.
You're on a roll there with that answer as well. Well, is there anyone else who would care to comment on the dash fours? Representative Greenlee, Representative Donham's answer was that...
I heard most of that.
Oh, very good. Thank you. Do you need any further elaboration?
No. Money does follow, but also some stays.
Money gets spread around, and I would be less than candid if I said SIO was making great piles of money. They do get some administrative expense, and they do get a little extra. And the sending school, I might say most of these students, the biggest part of them were homeschoolers. So most of these students generate money for their homeschool that they would have never seen.
Thank you, Chairman. Welcome. Chair Buckley and members of the committee. My name is Peter Stewart. I'm the Senior Vice President for School Development for K-12 Incorporated, which is a curriculum company. We provide curriculum to many of the online statewide programs around the nation, 15 in total. We also provide web-based solutions to high-tech classrooms in inner cities and rural areas, Native American reservations, et cetera. It sounds as if there are two discussions that were happening today. One, which was about the Oregon Virtual School District, which is a program of the Oregon Department of Education, as I understand it. I had the chance last year to go and testify first to testify in favor of that, and then to apply to be a member to that. My company wasn't able to be a part of that program. I think much to the chagrin of many Oregon residents who would like to have seen us be a part of that, mostly because the way that it was set up in the RFP. Our company would have to give up the intellectual property of our courses to the Oregon Virtual School District, and that was something that our folks just couldn't do. It would be like asking McGraw-Hill to give the galley prints of their books so you could just run off more copies. This is a process in motion, and we absolutely want to go back with Mr. Nelson and the Department of Education to try and be a part of that program. That program is similar to many others across the country, which is mostly intended for part-time. It's intended for some really valuable needs within the school system. Students who need credit recovery, students who can't find a highly qualified teacher in a rural area specifically. Sometimes it's difficult to find a highly qualified teacher who can teach physics. That means that teacher, by No Child Left Behind qualifications, has to have either major in that subject or pass a proficiency test in that subject. In some cases, you have someone who's a great science teacher teaching chemistry, and they're highly qualified, but they're not highly qualified in physics. And so a part-time program like the Oregon Virtual School District can be a great tool within a state to try and meet some of those needs. There are other needs that these programs can meet, and I believe that the proposal before you today is talking about some of those other types. For students who, for instance, are homebound right now, for whatever reason it might be, typically for medical reasons, others, a full-time program might be the right fit for them, and this bill, if passed, would allow a charter school to get up and running and then go before the state board and ask for a waiver to serve more than 50% of the students from outside of their district. The benefit of that is that virtual education is not the right fit for everybody. We know that. Even if it's for only 1 in 1,000, that's still a fairly large number when it's spread out across the entire state. So typically you won't have more than a few homebound students in a district. So it's not in the district's interest necessarily to set up a program like this. But with a high-quality provider or providers within the state, what you'll end up seeing is probably what I'm seeing in other states. There are programs that we've been a part of where they've asked us to come in and set up a program for pregnant teens, teen mothers. who really can't go to a regular school every day, so a full-time program can be a great benefit to them. There are special needs children who intellectually are capable of just excelling, but in a regular classroom setting, they don't do well. They may have social reasons, emotional reasons, whatever it might be. So the regular class setting with a bell that goes off every 45 minutes is not the best way for that child to learn. This is a public school choice option. The benefit, I think, of this bill is if you see fit to pass it, is that it provides a little bit of clarity. My understanding is that right now the State Board of Education could grant a waiver to anybody. If a charter school went before them right now and said, we'd like to offer a statewide program and we would like to be able to do that, they could do that today, and the State Board has that right to do so. What they don't have are quality standards. And when this debate began, or this discussion began back in February, in Vice Chair Comp's subcommittee, I think most of the concerns that were raised around quality and how do we make sure that the programs that do get to provide options across the state are high-quality programs. And I believe that Representative Cannon and Representative Dahlem focus most of their attention on building those high-quality standards, which is what I believe is before you. And, you know, it would be my contention that virtual education is here. Our students are doing it. I worked in Washington just last year, and they had one of their joint committees ask for a study on virtual education. They knew that the Federal Way School District and one or two others were doing this. What they found out was that 35 districts were doing this. They just didn't know. And so this is just a part of the kind of public school fabric that we have right now. The question is, you know, how will you make sure and ensure that you have high-quality providers? My company will benefit from a high-quality provision because we believe the movement has great potential. It also has great pitfalls. If someone comes in and basically just takes lesson plans that are nothing more than PDFs and posts them to a website, that's virtual education by some definitions. There are some programs that don't provide materials. They just say you go to the web, you get online, you look at. We know that students learn by doing. They learn science by doing science. They learn science by having the materials. And so we are 100% in favor of high quality parameters for the State Board to do this, so that if you are going to offer it, you can offer a program that you'll be proud of. That was long. Sorry.
One heck of an answer. Any questions? Representative Greenlee.
Basically, all the school districts are doing this. Why do you have to have a program that draws students out of the school districts they're in?
If every district, every district isn't doing this. I mean, I said in Washington there were 30. I think that there's, a couple hundred districts that are in the state of Washington. So 30 of them are doing something. One of the things that is helpful about a program being more regional or statewide is that once you get to a certain scale, you can't do it with part-time help. So if I were a superintendent right now and I had four kids that this would benefit, I could do it with some part-time help. I don't need to go hire a new special ed director. I don't need to hire a new business manager, things like that. Once you get to a certain scale, and this will get to scale fairly quickly, you can't do it with part-time help. And what ends up happening is that the small districts won't be able to handle large numbers. What this basically allows you to do is there's an economy of scale, so you can have one special ed director for all of your students who you're serving. These become very complicated operations to run. One of the things that we have found is that the logistics of a program like this, so you think about No Child Left Behind testing, it's very difficult to get your 95% participation rate when you have the kids coming into a building. When you have a virtual school that is a statewide program, in Washington right now they're going through their WASL testing, and our public school partners up there, the Steilacoom Historical School District, working with us, we're running, I think, 40 or 50 testing sites every day all across the state. And so once you get to scale, there's a level of complexity that benefits having one core group focused on this with 100% of their attention.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chaffetz? Well, but what I don't quite understand is why. I understand why you can have a virtual school.
Sure.
And right now there's a virtual school in one district somewhere, and it's drawing students from all,
that's right,
from other districts. I don't understand why it can't be sponsored by each district, and why you can't have it.
I think that it is right now. The charter school is sponsored by an individual district. But right now, the way the law reads, we're at one right now, one private operation. That's where we'll stay unless we open up the process, or at least make the process available to others.
But this process is for creating schools that can have students from District A and District B and District C. My question was, why can't this be set up in a way that District A sponsors the students in District A and keeps them
at I think the answer is economy of scale. And as we went out there and looked at what was going on, if each district...
I'm asking different questions. I'm saying let's go with the economy scale. You have one, okay. One provider.
Why can't each
district lease a piece of that provider for its own scale?
Because there's a
50%
I've got to understand your question, but maybe it's our scale. I'm looking at the Mitchell School District, and I'm looking at the Fossil School District.
My question: why can't the Fossil School District?
Because the maximum
spaces on this big virtual school.
They can, but the big virtual school can't get big unless it's limited to a huge metropolitan area. So if you had a large metropolitan area that had beaucoup students, that would give you a bigger scale to search for. But if you're, for example, out in the hinterland, we have an ESD that is partially into this. With a Eastern Oregon flavor, but our small districts, we have enrollments of 72, 101. I'm missing the question.
I think so. Can I try?
Yeah, Chair Buckley,
I think what you're describing is the future. I think you're describing a future 10 years from now, 7 years from now, where every school district will have some type of a program for themselves. What I have seen in other states is that the charter law is typically created to try and promote innovation, to lead the way in some sort of R&D, and that once a program is demonstrated to be effective, then you'll find the districts will say, oh, we could do this ourselves as well, and it will meet a specific need in our district. Is that answering the question?
No, it's not. Let me take a shot.
Over two.
Because I think it's a legitimate question. Right now, for instance, we take the Oregon Connection Academy as an example. I think President Greenlee's question is, why can't the Oregon Connections Academy have a charter agreement with the Scioto School District, the Salem School District, the Ashland School District, the Eugene School District, so
they can keep all their kids
Within the district, and then the 50-50 rule would not even be a factor. I believe that's
exactly my question.
Can I try to respond to that?
Go represent.
I think it's what's kind of evolving here is we're just not there yet, Representative Greenlee. And what I saw in this process was a big difference between some definitions that needed to be determined. What's a virtual school? What's a charter school? And our statutes are evolving, and my dream would be exactly what you're talking about. And I don't know how we can get there just yet, but right now, because when charter schools, to my perception, when charter schools started in Oregon a few years back, it was a beginning when people thought that there were going to be voucher schools and all this money would leave the public school system. But as school districts and the department and the Board of Education has worked through the process, it has not been that. It has been schools that have been adopted by individual districts. And I think the virtual schools or the virtual classroom is on that horizon yet, and we're just starting to define these things.
But what this program does, it seems to me, is it's a virtual school. It's not for a particular school district. It could be this big virtual school that simply sucks students out of all the different districts. And the money for those students out of the district. And I have a big problem with that whole idea.
Right now, and that was a question that was raised, you have to look at the makeup of the population. What we are doing is bringing more of Oregon's students under the umbrella of Oregon's education system. We are extending to those, I'm going to say 60% of the students at SIO are homeschoolers, or were. Then we have a small, and we did not, after we got that percentage figure, we did not break down the population anymore. Some are homebound, This is the answer and the only answer for them. Some are...
Well, this isn't the only answer.
Well, it's one of the answers.
You've been dealing with homebound students for many years.
For many years. But this is an answer for them. Some are geographically isolated. And we did get a rough notion, but we have brought 60% of that population under the Oregon public school umbrella through a charter, but we're not there before. So sucking the money out, what we're doing is providing service for more of Oregon's children.
Any questions? Mr. Kirby, did you have anything else to say?
I would say that, you know, nationwide, our experience is actually that about, I believe we serve right now about 25,000 full-time students nationwide in these programs, and only about 15% are homeschoolers. So these are kids who are already in the public school system. They're just looking for another choice. Typically what ends up happening is
That's my point. That's right. Exactly my point.
Right.
That's right.
And now they have another choice, and they go and they take their money with them.
That's right.
And that's my problem.
Right. Right. Yeah, Chair Greenwood. Chair.
He's a chair.
Not till three o'clock.
He's a sitting in chair.
Yes. My viewpoint is you may be 100% right on that, but if having students be available, have the availability to a virtual class versus, first of all, dropping out of school, not being served at their differentiated rate instruction, particularly for TAG students, that I'm willing to give this option an opportunity, because I know as students progress, sometimes the regular brick, and I hate this term, brick and mortar school really doesn't have what it takes to challenge all students. So I'm, you know, it's just trying to weigh all that out.
Mr. Chair, did you have something to say?
Yes, I'm not sure whether I can ask you a question, maybe Representative Dallum. And when the money flows out to the charter school, how much do they keep this fund?
There is a minimum threshold. 80% is the minimum that can be sent to a charter. There are other contracts, and I'm not. I know that we had one that was 85% in the school district I was familiar with, but the school that is teaching the student gets a minimum of 80% and could get more. I'm not sure what the breakdown is presently in SIL, but I think there's somebody who could answer that.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, my question is, even there might be a cost of administration, staying in, you know, giving 80% and a 20%, 50%, there's a lot of money left over there. Why, instead of going to the student, why do they keep it at the money for administrative cost?
That went through this legislative process, I believe, in the 1999 session. And the issue was, I recall the Brownsville Academy and Jim Ackley, and he had contracted with the Central and School District. I was the superintendent. We gave them 35%. Some said that was sinful, and that was why the 80% threshold was it was felt that most of the money should follow the student, but that there was some administrative expense. The present law assumes that 20% administrative fee is a fair figure.
Okay. I'm not satisfied.
Representative, I do understand your concern. I share that concern. I am still not quite clear in terms of how much money the SIL School District receives, how much money the Oregon Connections Academy receives. I'm concerned about money leaving our state. It's Oregon education dollars. And if anyone would care to comment on that, I'd be glad to listen to their response.
I just want to make one more comment.
Representative Lynn.
Yes, and in my opinion, as I hear the older testimony and discussion here, we cannot afford not to do it. You know, many other states are doing it, and eventually we are going to lift out. We need to compete it. And another point I want to bring it up, that the Representative Greenwood's concern that they siphon out the students. And if we are going to get healthy competition, it should be. The money should follow the student, not the system.
Thank you.
That's my comment.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regards to the actual contract between the Oregon Connections Academy and the Scioto School District and the sending school districts from the standpoint of the amounts of money, Jim Thomas is here and probably could answer that question more accurately than
I can. Thank you, Chairman, for your time. Okay.
But basically, and Jim will correct me if I'm wrong, basically 80% goes to Oregon Connections Academy, 10% goes to the sending school district, and 10% is held by the Scioto School District. But like I said, he can correct me if I'm wrong. I think one of the things that we need to keep track of here, keep in mind here, are we doing what's best for the system? Are we doing what's best are we doing this for the money? Or are we doing this because what's best for the student? And if we're doing this because of what's best for the student and the choices that the student and their families want to make, then this is a very obvious thing to do, is to approve this. If what we want to do is, if we're worried about protecting the system and if we're worried about the money and that sort of thing, then, you know, maybe you have to think about it. But, I mean, from my perspective, I don't have to think about it.
Sure.
Because it's what's best for the student.
Exactly.
I really believe that every school district ought to be working very hard to meet the needs of their students.
Absolutely.
And they ought to have all the tools available. And I don't think the notion that that's a notion that's dealing with the money. The problem is they need the money to do the alternative things that need to be done to take care of the students they have. And to simply siphon the students off doesn't... doesn't help them meet the responsibility they have to deal with the handicapped student, with the tag student, and the board student, which in my experience was me and a big problem, and lots of other students. I think we need to do everything we can to help the home districts deal with what they need. I'd be very interested, I mean, that's why I was raising that question, and making sure the home districts, within their own competence, would have the ability to buy into these kinds of systems for the students they need. But I think just sucking the students out of the district and saying, well, that solved the problem, I don't believe it solves the problem at all.
Representative Dahl?
Having been a superintendent, and our model was built a century before I became part of it, we built a system that literally had cutoffs. If you achieved the eighth grade, that was fine enough. If you achieved high school, that was fine enough. And in the good years, I believe this legislative assembly gave us, it was double-digit dollars. And with those dollars, we were able to do a lot of things, but we can never do the spectrum in economic workforce development, workforce and economic development committee, which meets in this room in the mornings. We can't waste a child, and we can't cover them all with the spectrum of education we have in the public system. The percentage of students that are taking advantage of this is infinitesimal. And it is one tool, and I guess I'm speaking as a former superintendent, it is one tool that I had at my disposal to provide an education to another kid that I might not have been able to reach. I don't think we're...
Let me give our guest a chance to chime in here. Please, if you say your name for the record and any thoughts you might have. Welcome, Representative.
My name is Jim Thomas. I'm the principal of Oregon Connections Academy and the former superintendent of the Scioto School District. And I just wanted to, give a clarification that the agreement between the Oregon Connections Academy and the Scioto School District, and Jeff is the chairman of our board, could clarify this if I'm incorrect, but I believe that it's we actually have 90% of the funds going to the Oregon Connections Academy, which puts more money into the hands of the students.
And Mr. Chairman, former State Representative Jeff Krupp and Chairman of the Oregon Connections Academy School Board, we also give 5% of that 10% of the amount of money that's left. 5% goes to the Scioto School District for their administrative costs, which have been considerable in the last 2 years as we've set up a number of policies and procedures for accountability, which we've agreed are a good thing. And the other 5% goes back to the sponsoring or the school district from where the child came from. Our current statistics are 45% of our children are homeschooled children who would not have been counted in any public school environment, quote-unquote, bricks and mortar. We have some other categories of students, and I will tell you that I just had lunch a few minutes ago with a gentleman whose son has autism and is in public school and is very unhappy with the particular school district and how they're dealing with him, and is looking for an alternative opportunity to provide a quality education for his son in this circumstance. And we do have some of those children. We are in our next budget, which I've just seen for our third year of operation. And keep in mind, we started with 700 students. We are now over 1,500 students. And we are turning away students on a regular basis. And not all the students who also attend our school, by the way, stay with us. For some, it simply doesn't work. It isn't a good option. They try it. And for others, it's working very, very well. Now, let me say that in our new budget, we are hiring at considerable expense an IEP coordinator and a half-time or a one-and-a-half FTE to help coordinate that. The IEP we don't get any IEP dollars at all. For our special ed students, and we have several, we don't get any money for them. The sponsor, the school district where the child has come from, gets the money for it. And we're expending money to handle that. And most of the school districts from where we're getting those students really are not doing a great deal of work there. And the other thing I would point out, my last point I would point out to you, is that Connections Academy, which is the folks that we contract with for not only the curriculum but to manage our school district, I would ask you to think of them in terms of a superintendent positions and the administration activities of a superintendent. In other words, if you had a school district of 2,000 students, they would typically have a superintendent and staffing to go along with that administration. They also function in the accounting mold. In other words, they do all the accounting for us, which ESDs do for a lot of school superintendents and school districts today in terms of writing the checks, figuring their PERS retirement, so on and so forth. They also provide us with the technical support for all of the computers, so when a child or their parent has a computer problem, they do that. They also, quite frankly, act as our bank. When we had our money cut off at the beginning of the school year, they were willing to fund us for however long it took for us to accomplish that. They also do all of our enrollment work. They also do all of our HR services. So when we talk about the issue, I would like for you to think about this in terms of a 2,000-person school district, which is what we will be next year, is that would require a complete superintendent and all of that administrative staff and still contracts with local ESDs to provide those accounting functions and so on and so forth. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would like to make one clarification, Mr. Sure. Chairman, members of the committee. The weighted funding for the special ed goes to the local district, just as a clarification.
Thank you. Representative Cobb.
Well, that was part of the clarification, so I need to use an example. If Salem School District has a special ed student, which is the meaning of a student with an individual education plan, they would get $7,500 for one student. If they were a special ed student, they would get $15,000, correct?
That would be correct. If that were the dollar amount, that would be correct.
Right, if that was the dollar amount for the per student allocation. Therefore, when a special ed student leaves Salem Kaiser School District, they would receive, in essence, 55% of that child's funding, and you would receive 45%.
Well, we got a waiver from the Oregon Board of Education, and right now, if it's a 2% or 2 ADM, the local district sending district get one, and we would get one. We split it right down the middle this time.
Right, but with the administrative part, and there was the 55-45. And the same thing was true for using the weighted formula for poverty and second language students?
It would be the same, I do believe. I think ask about it at this time. Yeah. I'm more familiar with what we do with the special ed funding.
Okay, so you don't haven't had the
experience. Gary is the Gary Temple, the superintendent of SIO, basically would probably be the better one to ask that in terms of that funding.
Free lunch program.
Well, what?
Closest thing is free.
What I'm trying to get to makes a very interesting dynamic all the way around. When you're a school district and you're not having to quote unquote bear the responsibility of a special student or a student that is learning English as a second language. Students, I believe, and I know Cindy Hunt's here, but I believe they can get up to 2.5 of the funding weighted formula. So,
three.
Okay, Stan corrected. So, it's just an interesting thing that's happening here. Yeah, I just, of all the funding pieces, it's just something else.
Thank you, Representative. You haven't spoken much this afternoon.
I have been
very quiet to this point. I have talked with the people and talked with John, and I want to commend the people and Representative Cannon for all the work, because there's a lot of good stuff in this bill. And I have three major objections. The number one is I think that, and I'm one of those people who like the charter school laws, and I like them the way they are with the 50%, and I don't like stuff, and I get in arguments with my friends about that all the time. But the issue is, from my perspective, this should be at the state board level. It shouldn't be in an individual school district. It creates situations where we have smaller districts who are having a very hard time keeping afloat, using this as a way to get a little bit of extra money to keep their administration going in their districts, and it will set up competition. That frustrates me, because I think the policy should be the state has a responsibility to offer this, and it should be done from the state board in one place, like the virtual school. The virtual school is not ready. They should be contracting with SIO to be the one, in my opinion. That's how I would go out there and look at a couple of these vendors, and if they each could do a kind of thing and their schools are appropriate and they hire the right people and they do a lot of the things that are in this bill, that's where I would go with it. And I've had that conversation with the people here. They understand that about me. Here are the reasons that I have a hard time with it. And I think, you know, we passed a bill out of here, which I support, and I think most of the people in the community did, that said we're going to help these rural small schools survive.
Right.
And this, to me, is the antithesis of that. Because one in two students in those schools who choose to go this route take $150,000, you know, take their money out of those school districts, and that's what keeps them afloat. And everyone that leaves, and we heard those superintendents talk about that. We are necessary small schools in these places, and I have some in my district, like Mapleton and Reedsport and others that are right on the edge. And one in two students a year continually getting smaller is what's killing them. And when they don't have a say in it, when these people leave, I watch these things fall apart. Now, on the converse of that, some of them are going to go away, and we have to have, as a state, something for them.
Right.
And that's why I think it should be at the state level. So that's my whole issue with this bill, is that, and with SIO. And it goes also to another one I talked about, and that is that we had another school district who tried to do this and went through the whole process until the end, when the state board said no, and that was Coquille, which is not in my district. It's actually 15 miles away from us. And so SIO's starting, and they're saying no, and it just about destroyed that school district, because they had invested in, they were ready to go, and they went away. I mean, and then they couldn't do it. So they have been trying to regroup since that happened, and felt very frustrated, and there was a lot of angst about that whole situation. And so I think this bill does some things that, you know, I think other charter people are really upset that they did. It put back into statute a whole lot of the exemptions that we've given charter schools. And I know that Representative Lynn was upset about the 80% thing, not following the student. But, you know, we have a lot of other requirements that we put on regular school districts with respect to how they go about hiring people, how they go about doing things. And those things cost money. And they don't go away when you lose two or three students. We still have to do them. And charter schools are exempt from a lot of those.
And at the beginning of this process, I think that's a, I was agreeing with that. I think we need to look at some of the same things, and having options for kids is really important. So I'm okay with that. But that still stays at the local district, battling it out with respect to whether they should have them and whether the school district is doing the right thing with the next charter school that comes in. My district has the responsibility to do things for those kids, and like Representative Greenlick said, I think they have the responsibility to meet the needs of every one of those kids, and some of those need this kind of a school. And I have not heard anything, and I've talked to a number of students. There was a young lady that was here a couple days ago as an honorary page who was a member of the school from Reesport and had nothing but glowing reports to say about it. I mean, I have not heard one student that I've talked to from this academy who has said bad things about it. Now, there may be some out there, I just haven't had a chance to see them. So I'm not saying that they aren't doing that. But the reality is that person is not now... Reesport is not now responsible for that person, but they are responsible. Our state requires the school district to be responsible for every one of those children that's in their school district. And they've given that away to a school district over which they had no control to give it away to, but it was taken. So that's why I think it has to be vested at the state level, not at the city level. And I don't know that any of these programs would have any problem with that. It's just that they didn't have an option before to do that. Their only option was to go to an individual school district. I think this is one of those things that policy-wise, as a state, we really have to look at and we have to get serious about. And this one, from my perspective, doesn't quite do that. Now, that all being said, I have... we'll see how the vote comes out. And I committed to Mr. Cannon and to Representative Dahlman, but I'd give a courtesy yes if I needed to. But I think there's enough votes to pass this out, and they can do that. And when it gets to the floor, I'll give my argument the same way, because I have real strong feelings about charter schools and about how we go about making policy in the state. And from my perspective, this is not the best policy. And I think I've been honest with you guys all along, exactly where I feel and why I feel that way. But to Representative Greenlicks and others, conference, I really do believe that local districts have an obligation to every one of their kids. And I, for one, have believed that if his parents choose homeschooling, I think that's great. And if they come and ask the school, I want to take that class in your building, I say, you have every right to have that class in that building, and we invite them in, if it's banned, if it's whatever, because we are public schools, and every one of those kids, we have an obligation to help in any way we can. So, it's all those things. So, now we'll be quiet.
You saved it up, and you saved it up and did it well. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Representative, do you have anything you want to say on top of that?
Having been through this process, I have a file of 1.5 feet thick, but I think that there's not an issue that's been mentioned today that Representative Cannon or myself did not look at. We certainly ended up in a different place than we started. I think all the concerns that Representative Roblin has would be answered with this bill or by turning the entire charter school, cyber charter school issue to the state board. It comes out the same, but I think it's a good bill. It has, the thing that, and Representative Cannon's words are ringing in my ears, he didn't want his cousin Vinny putting together a cyber school in his basement with a single computer and a disk and a textbook. And that's where we went, was to ensure quality. We have cyber schools. We've got one here now. We are either going to try and attempt to hold back the future, or we're going to let the future come over us, and we're going to control it. And I think that's where Representative Cannon and I were. I think this bill does that. Whether we do the dash 2 or the dash 4 is a... that's not as important as the fact that we do the bill. I would like to question, Mr. Chair, do we need a referral to Ways and Means? I question that.
We do have a referral to Ways and Means on this bill. And the longer I've heard the discussion, I do think that's a good place for it to go, considering the funding form that we're talking about and the amount of money that impacts the K-12 system. It's my understanding, if Donald, correct me if I'm wrong, Jimmy, correct me if I'm wrong as well. If we would not pass this bill, virtually nothing would have changed. I mean, the 50-50 rule is still in effect. It's still in effect when this, if this bill should pass. The only difference that we're making is putting requirements that the state board would have to consider when considering the waiver of the 50-50 bill.
That's where we went with this bill. It's to ensure quality. Nothing would change except that you would have a quality assurance above and beyond the state board of ed would be given direction. That's what the bill does.
Thank you, Representative. And, I have additional thought, and I just lost it.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just add one thing. We very much support the concept of having at the state board level some standard criteria that will ensure that Cousin Vinny doesn't do precisely what Representative Cannon is afraid would happen. We think ultimately that hurts public education, period, no matter how you deliver it, to have that type of a delivery system and not having standards in place to do that. Second thing is I would share with you that it's not only just test scores by which we measure educational success, I believe. It's also, are the parents happy with what's going on in the school district? And I know that those of you that are education professionals have experienced this many times over, parents happy or unhappy with how things are occurring. And I just gave you the story of the gentleman I had lunch with today. 94% of the parents that we polled this year are very pleased with the results and the experience that they've had with our particular school district. I think that is a very, very profound thing to recognize publicly, that parents also think that this is a good direction for them. Again, it's not for every child, and it's not for every parent. Parents are an integral part of making what I think is a successful virtual online learning environment really be successful for a child. They also have to be committed to it. And if they're not going to be committed, then they shouldn't try. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate your indulgence.
Let me hear your voice again, Representative.
Congress is not saying.
There are no requests.
This is Mayor Dahl. She's a former honorable.
He was born with the honorable, I suppose. Representative Cobb.
Mr. Chair, are you ready for a motion?
I'm ready for a motion, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I move the -4 amendments to House Bill 2037. And with the due pass as recommended, with
you got to do dash four first.
Thank you. The next part.
Representative Comp has moved the -4 amendments to House Bill 2037. Is there further discussion? I certainly hope not.
There is one
representative
comment. Personally, I prefer -3 because it's the school board and the Department of Education is the final instead of going forward. Am I correct?
The way the bill was originally written, the appeal process was assumed to be there. The way the -4 is, there is an appeal process.
-4 is not talking about. And -3 is the Department of Education is the final.
The state board of ed gets the first hearing and the last.
Yeah,
it's rather odd in the American jurisprudence system where you have one agency with the first and last voice, but that's what the -3 would.
Yes. So to me, in this case, -3 would make more sense because it's a finalizing. Of course, they have a right to take to the court, but at least the statute says that's the limit.
Since they don't have the right to take it,
that precludes them from taking it to court.
That's what I'm talking about.
So, Representative, you would prefer to see the state board be the final word?
I believe so, in my opinion. But I'm willing to go that the -4, if the -3, if I don't have enough support here.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Coppers and Roland, or the Wilson, or Fennell, any feelings on.
Mr. Chair, thank you for asking. I'd support Amendment 4.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I support the -4 amendments also.
Thank you very much. Representative Lim, I appreciate your input. It seems the will of the committee is to go with the -4.
Yes,
I do understand your concerns.
Yes.
I appreciate it. Any further discussion on the -4 amendment? Any objection to the -4 amendment? So adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2037 with the -4s I'm going to start all over. I move House Bill 2037 to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee by prior reference.
Representative Kopp has moved House Bill 2037 to the floor as amended, the due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means due prior reference. Is there any discussion?
My only question, Mr. Chair, is since this doesn't have an expenditure in it, would it be possible to lift the rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
President, I feel like it was not given the activity of the past 24 hours, I was not able to talk to the Speaker directly concerning this. And in testimony today, with some of the questions brought up by Representative Greenick, does give me concerns in terms of how this works financially. I would like to be able to dig in with Ways and Means on the financial arrangements with the school. So we're going to keep the referral.
Okay. I am trying to figure out, Mr. Chair, from the original bill, why the original bill was subsequently referred to Ways and Means. Because in reading the original bill, it probably shouldn't have been. But I don't get to make that call.
You're the Ways and Means Chair.
I understand, but there are some things that don't belong there, and this happens.
Any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Clem.
Aye, excused.
Representative Don.
Aye.
Representative Greenwood.
No.
Representative Crump.
Aye.
Representative Crummel.
Aye.
Representative Lynn.
Aye.
Representative Roebland.
No.
Representative Woodman.
Aye.
I'm going to give this a courtesy yes. The motion passes.
Thank you for your work, Representative Donald. We really appreciate the time and effort you put into this.
Yes, enjoyed it every minute.
I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2037, and we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2214. Mr. Wilson, when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2214 directs the Legislative Assembly to appropriate to public education programs, funds, and agencies an amount that is not less than 61% of the projected revenues in the general fund beginning with the 2007-2009 biennium. Rather than reading through this whole thing, since the committee has heard this a couple times, and we have a couple more amendments. 61%
of general fund revenues.
Yes. Since we have a couple amendments, I need to summarize, and we're starting to run tight on time. There are two amendments for consideration that are not mutually exclusive. There's a dash 2, which replaces the entire text of 2214 and adds a 4 to the state school fund of no less than 80% of the money to be determined to be sufficient for that biennium by the Quality Education Commission. It deletes the baseline amount appropriation, and it changes the name of the pre-K through grade 12 successful schools account to the school improvement account, clarifies the formula and for K-12 and post-secondary funds distribution, and clarifies some of the language on the school improvement fund account. That was the one we had up for discussion last time. In response to some of the discussion, there's now a dash 3, which also would direct the Joint Boards of Education to, quote, recommend performance measures on accountability and quality, and direct the governor to include these in the budget report, and direct the legislature to review these measures. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson, and members. I believe what we're going to do, we have permission to refer this to rules instead, and can you do additional policy work on it? There was a discussion with the Speaker's office concerning Representative Comp's bill on the education design team, the idea that we could focus 2214 during the rules committee discussion to work in tandem somehow with the education design team concept, and that's pretty much what we're going for. Representative Wisnett was encouraged us to bring forward the amendments that we have before us in terms of the accountability measure, and we have heard a good deal of discussion on this bill. If there are additional questions, I'd be happy to entertain them, but if there is a motion, I'd be happy to entertain that as well.
Vice Chair Krupp.
Thank you. Yes, I move, Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2214.
Representative Kopp is moving the dash two. Is dash two amendments, or are we on the?
We have to move both.
The dash two amendments to House Bill 2214. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none.
Yeah, the dash two talks about 80 before being 80% of the QM. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlink, the dash two is essentially the main rewrite of the bill, and it just adds in 80%, but retains the main parts of the original bill.
The 61 and the 80?
The 61, the 110, and now the 80.
Is it the highest of all those?
Mr. Sager,
perhaps we would want to have.
Good to see you.
Thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. And for the record, James Sager, Governor's Office. Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlink, the 80% is an additional floor guarantee for K-12. So the primary bill is a minimum 10% increase. But if that 10% increase did not keep us above the 80% floor for K-12, the 80% floor would kick in as the baseline minimum. So it's those two that play against each other, not the 61% for the overall fund.
How does 61% fit into that?
The Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlink, the 61% is how we determine the total pot of money as the minimum level of funding that goes to the education enterprise.
K-20.
Through 20. Correct.
And the 80% is only K-12?
It's only a portion of
K-12. Yeah. Currently.
Mr. Rubin?
Not a question. We have retained the idea, though, of having a quality education model for community colleges.
Chair Buckley, Representative Roblin, yes, for post-secondary, that's another bill that's mentioned, but yes, that is moving ahead.
Okay. I want to make sure that we're still working on that one. I need to invite this one.
Representative Whitman, I could ask later, but I'll go ahead and ask it. So, Mr. Chair, thank you. And thank Mr. Sager and his office for helping me work on the dash three, which I hope we'll put in too.
Yes.
I've never asked you this, but is there an escape clause if we have a tsunami, an earthquake? Is there an escape clause in here?
Chair Buckley, Representative Wisnett, I'm sorry I didn't have my folder open. Yes, we have an escape clause, as you mentioned, both for the legislature and the governor, that in fact, if there are unknown circumstances, whether it be an initiative vote by voters of Oregon that somehow put a damper on the budget or a major recession, we have the ability to make adjustments. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Is the governor going to come in with a floor for human services as well? I mean, will he come in with a proposal of 61 of this, 28 of that, 14 of this?
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlink, no, the governor is not and has not had a discussion about making such a proposal. The focus has been that the governor sees education as the economic driver for the state, and the only way that we keep the economy growing is to have a well-trained and educated workforce. It is the only way we reduce the demand on both the prison system, correction system, and the need for the social safety net that we have in place. So the governor is not trying to pit systems against each other. What he's trying to do is make it clear that as a priority both for students, but then as a priority for the economic driver of the state, that this is important.
Well, yeah, I think it's important too. I mean, I'm happy to say education first, and also happy to say your health plan first, and also happy to say services for the elderly first, because I believe all those things should be first. But so, I mean, it makes me a little nervous getting committed in advance to take out 61% out of it when we have the prisons, which the governor thinks is automatic. So we take the prisons out of it, and then, oops, what's left? What's left is for everything else. And the whole concept makes me very nervous.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Lynn.
Yes, and I'd like to share the same sentiment. that it might be, it is make legislators easier to get the job done, because already formula there, 61% and 10% and minimum 80% of the QEM. So that's the formula there. But at the same time, and deeply concerned, economy up and down. But as I look at the past two biennia and the coming the four biennia, always has been kicking in 61%. And this is the chart you gave me in an average sense. And also always above the 80% of QEM. So since that happening in the past and currently, why do we need this?
Chair Buckley, Representative Lim, I understand the document you're looking at, and actually what it demonstrates is the fact that we have not been above the 80% trigger for K-12. We have not been above the 60% minimum when it comes to general fund revenue. If I were to have given you tracking on each of the sectors of the education enterprise over the past several years, it fluctuates quite dramatically. In fact, over the recent several biennia, as you know, because of special sessions and everything else, we've had we've made promises and then pulled the rug out from underneath the system. What the governor was attempting to do was to design a plan whereby we could both provide some stable forecasting of revenue for the education system so that they can actually make plans as to how they rebuild the system. Right now, the concern for school districts, community colleges, universities is we don't dare begin to rebuild the programs we need, because 2 years from now the money may be pulled out and now we're going to have to make cuts again and pull programs out. So the governor was trying to lay out a path whereby we provide that kind of stable, predictable funding as a baseline and have an investment fund that's attached to it that is part of the bill that moves this state for the first time ever in the direction of meeting the stated goal of the state, which is funding the quality education model for K-12, and also, as the governor has stated repeatedly, to move us back into a reinvestment strategy in our community colleges and university systems. So as I testified in one of the previous hearings, the one target that we have that is very clear for the university system, for instance, is that prior to Measure 5, we had a distribution of about 70% of the funding came from the state, 30% came from tuition. That has absolutely flip-flopped since the passage of Measure 5 and shifting priorities to K-12 and a disinvestment in the university system. What the governor's proposal does, based on current revenue forecasts, is that by the 13-15 biennium, not only do we get to 97% of the quality ed model for K-12, we move over 90% of the way towards the goal of restoring that balance of state support versus tuition. So again, we're setting up an environment where Oregonians have access and opportunity to go on to a post-secondary education system.
Thank you, Mr. Sager. Members, if it is possible, since the purpose of having this on the agenda today is to move it to rules, basically to keep the discussion alive, if there is a particular point that you would like to make, I don't want to not let you make that point, but if you're comfortable getting either a courtesy yes or no to send this to rules.
I'm very conflicted because everything Jim just said resonates to me, but I'm going to particularly learn much about the Social Service Budget Bill. I'll be a yes, but it's a nervous yes.
Thank you, Representative.
Do you have a motion? We already have a
motion. Motion on the dash twos.
All right. Any objection to dash two?
No.
Hearing none, so amended.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments to House Bill 2214.
Representative Kopp has moved the dash three amendments to House Bill 2214. Any discussion? Hearing none, any objections? So amended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2214 to the House floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Rules Committee with a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee by prior reference.
Thank you, Representative.
issues with this.
Thank you. Vice Chair Compton moved House Bill 2214, House Floor Review passes amended recommendation. The bill be referred to the Rules Committee with a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee by prior reference. Discussion?
Request.
Did you say Joint Ways and Means or by Rules?
Add so the Rules first,
okay.
Then Ways and Means. So.
This will be a long
journey. Long, happy journey. Rips, well, thank your voice.
Yes, I have asked Mr. Sager 20 questions. He has answered every one of them. And adroitly, completely, and I am conflicted. I'm not concerned about settling education first. I was on that bandwagon last year. Heavy. So I can't look him in the eye and say, I believe in what he's trying to do. I have not had a chance to check with the chancellor or with the community colleges. So I'm going to ask, and this is this politics in this building. Did you know that?
I did, yes.
Here comes some. I'd like the roll to be called in the reverse order. Mr. Clem and I always get to vote first. We want to vote last this time.
I would entertain that request.
Will the clerk call the roll in the reverse order, please?
Representative
Yes.
Representative Roblin?
Yes.
Representative Lim?
Yes. Representative Crum? Aye.
Representative
Greenlight?
Nervous, yes. Gollum? Courtesy, yes. Representative Clem? Yes. Chair Buckley? Yes. Thank you, members. The motion carries. The election rules and the election means. Members, we have about 6 minutes left. We're trying to figure out which one of these bills might take a short period of time on our agenda. We do have some discussion on 2790. I think that's going to take more than 6 minutes for us to have that discussion. Representative Kopp on House Joint Memorial 3, have you, is there anything else? I need to close the work session on House Bill 2214. Representative Kopp, did you, have there any, been there further movement on that? Or
Actually, Chair Buckley, I believe we could make a decision within 6 minutes on, I had two options drafted, the two amendments are the dash ones and dash twos.
Will that Mr. Olson clarify?
Yeah.
I'm going to open up a work session on House Joint Memorial 3.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Joint Memorial 3, we have the Dash 2 Amendment, which would, first of all, the original bill urges Congress to adequately fund the No Child Left Behind Act 2001. Okay. The amendments change the purpose of the Joint Memorial. The Dash 2, everything replaces the Dash 1, which was under discussion, and they're much more cautious, I would say. The Dash 2 replaces the entire text and would address a memorial to the U.S. Secretary of Education, reiterate federal and state requirements for testing of students in math and English, the annual yearly progress requirements, the need to meet state standards by 2014 or face sanction, refer to the disruption of Oregon state assessment and clarify the disruption was not caused by public schools or students, and request the U.S. Department of Education work with Oregon authorities in determining if adequate yearly progress has been met for 2006-2007 if Oregon scores drop to a level suggesting that the, quote, disruption of service by the assessment contractor, unquote, caused the drop. Does not refer to the assessment contractor by name. The Dash 3 amendment replaces the entire text and strips down even further, basically taking out the whereas is discussing the federal state requirements on math and English, annual yearly progress, state standards. So if you look at them side by side, the one, two, three, the first... the first three whereases in the dash two are not in the dash three.
Say it again, excuse me?
The first three whereases clauses in the dash two amendment are not in the dash three. So the dash three is the most stripped down, but neither of them mention the company involved, and they're, I would say, more diplomatically worded, as Representative Wisnett has suggested during the previous discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
And Chair, I would leave the recommendation really up to Representative Wisnett. I personally like the Dash 3 because in honor of Representative Roblin's plain speak bill.
No,
No, it's Riley's.
Oh, yeah, Riley, Representative Riley. It says it clearly, succinctly, and yet I can understand it.
Representative Wisnett, the ball's in your court, apparently.
I defer to Representative Cobb. It's her bill, and I think both of those are acceptable.
I would accept, a motion on a dash three amendment. Well, let's make the motion first.
I move the dash three amendments into HJM 3.
Well, Vice Chair Cobb has moved the dash three amendments to House Joint Memorial 3. Discussion, Representative Donald.
Two concerns. One is we started down the road of asking for full funding of No Child Left Behind, which was noble and stood on its own merits. The federal government has told our schools what they have to do. As a recipient of that money, I could not live without it. But on the contrary, I could not live with it.
There is a Senate...
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Dahm, the Subcommittee on Education and Innovation will be considering on Tuesday a Senate Joint Memorial 12, which deals with the issue of full funding of No Child Left Behind. Thank you.
I will do it. Thank you very much. Thank you for that. The second provision, we are in a legal battle right now. I am new to get in the middle of that.
Thank you, Representative. Are you comfortable with this keeping us out of the legal battle?
I don't think
we want
to.
I'm not sure.
I still talks about
that's fine. Any further discussion on dash three? Hearing none, any, do you want to do a roll?
Or do you want to start?
We don't care anymore. We didn't care the first time.
All eyes. Let's go ahead and do a roll call on the dash three amendment.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative
Dahlin? Aye. Representative Greenlick?
Excuse.
Representative
Tom?
Aye.
Representative Tummel?
Aye.
Representative
Lynn?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative
Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Buckley?
Aye.
Motion carries. Representative
Tom. Mr. Chair, I move House JM3 to the House floor with a be adopted as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair Cobb has moved House Joint Memorial 3 to the floor for a do pass recommendation, to be adopted recommendation as amended. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk please call the roll. There's any Clem voting on the bill itself, the memorial itself.
Aye.
Representative Dahlin?
No.
Representative
Greenlick? Excuse.
Representative Clark?
Aye.
Representative Clark?
Aye.
Representative
Clark?
Aye.
Representative
Wilson? Aye. Aye. The motion carries and the close the work session of House Joint Memorial 3. Thank you, members. We're going to carry over, and my apologies to the folks who are here for these bills, so we will carry over the following bills: House Bill 2606, House Bill 3141, House Bill 2584, House Bill 2790, to Monday, April 30th at 1 p.m. In Hearing Room D for work sessions. Members, thank you for your work today and your attention. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. I look forward to seeing you on Monday.
You're adjourned.